Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. This is an unusual Drinks Insider episode. It's one where I've interviewed somebody because I'm in love with the products. Morten Sorensen is the creator of Ish, a non-alcoholic line from Denmark. It's got non-alc gin and tonic, non-alc palomas, non-alc daiquiris, spiced rum, and even wine. Although I haven't tried the wines yet, the spirits analogues are among some of the best I've tasted, and now they're sold in 25 markets. What was even better from my point of view is that Morten turned out to be not just a great innovator, but a great conversationalist and a great businessman as well. It's not everybody who can convince a motor company to do a marketing exercise with a brand that's alcohol adjacent, that's for sure. Doing this interview was a lot of fun and I learned a lot, including the benefits of having a friend who's a handyman. So I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Now, I have an announcement. The Drinks Insider podcast is now fortnightly rather than weekly, as I've started a new podcast with the wonderful Luli Halsted called A Question of Drinks. It's like the Freakonomics of Drinks, where we tackle questions like, does award-winning wine taste better? How did the gin and tonic change geopolitics? And why is everybody drinking rosé? It lands every other Wednesday, and you can find it on Apple, Amazon, and Spotify. And don't forget, sign up to the Drinks Insider newsletter at drinksinsider.com. Hi, Morten. Thanks for joining me.
It's good to be here. Thank you, Felicity, for having me on the podcast.
Okay, I can see behind you lots of bottles of Ish. So let's get into it. How did you start Ish? What made you decide to do this?
So back in 2017, I was traveling around the world. I was living as a digital nomad, and my Instagram was called Morty's Office of the Day. So I had a new office every day, pretty much. I lived in LA for about 5 years at that point. I'm from Copenhagen originally. And I just decided after spending some years in LA that I wanted to explore more of the world. So since I was running a creative agency at that time, I just took my laptop under my arm and I just went out into the world and just explored and worked on different clients. And what I realized in that period was that, you know, either you meet people that you know in different countries or you meet people that, you know, friends of friends. And there's always an excuse to have a drink. You know, it's the kind of the social glue. And especially when you're not on home turf and you're exploring the world and you just want to experience and have a good time, of course. And I realized in that period that alcohol was kind of slowing me down.
Right.
So I'm very disciplined in my work. I've always, you know, enjoyed being healthy and live healthy and mindfully. But the alcohol was just kind of like that element that slowed the roll. Like I, you know, even just like, you know, like some beers or some drinks on a weekday. And I wouldn't get the workout in the day after. Maybe I wouldn't get the exact kind of work done that I wanted to, and I'll kind of push the creative ideas for another day, and I got tired of it. So I decided I'm going to quit alcohol for 100 days and just see what happens, right? And I remember doing it with meat before as well, where I was like, I'm not going to eat meat for 100 days, let's see what happens, which wasn't difficult because I was living in LA at that time. But
yeah.
But the alcohol was difficult. Like it wasn't difficult not drinking it because I just decided not to. But, and I didn't have a dependency on it, but it was really difficult drinking, you know, going out because, there wasn't any alternatives at that point. Not in the same shape and form there is today. There was, of course, some great brands, but nothing in the distribution that we're seeing today. So I decided in that phase that I was like, I'm going to create a non-alcoholic brand that makes it easy to be a mindful drinker. And that was kind of the thing, because my intention was never not to drink alcohol again. It was just to kind of explore my relationship to alcohol. And that's why, you know, I was like, I just want to make that easy for anybody. And there must be more people like me.
Okay. So I think lots of people have the same problem, but they don't then go out and launch a brand. When you say a creative agency, what was your business background, or what is your business background?
So I worked in the creative industry since I was 17 years old. I started working at an advertising agency, mainly making coffee for creatives.
Your beverage background right there.
That's my beverage background, exactly. And I don't even drink coffee. Well, so I had to just kind of work myself up in the creative industry. I thought it was exciting and interesting and just kind of learning firsthand what it meant to be in that industry. And I slowly worked myself up and started my own agency when I was 22, together with a partner, an American partner named Aaron, who was a colleague. And her and I, we decided to start our own little agency back in 2006, actually. So it was a long time ago. And then we just started working on clients, creative jobs and stuff like that, and did everything from concept development to communication to brand development and all the comms and so on. So that was kind of my background.
So fast forward, you decide that you're going to create a non-alcoholic brand. How did you start? What was your, what was your process?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I had no experience in developing beverages. Like that was not, I didn't know anything about that. So, but what I knew was developing brand and developing, or just kind of following my heart in that of like, if I want to start a brand, if I want to do something, what's the purpose of it? What's the meaning of this? Like the world doesn't need any more products, but it needs products that actually make a difference. So that's what I've always been working on with the clients that I've been working on, being like, let's figure out why you exist or what's your reason to exist, basically, and your purpose. And that was kind of the angle of Ish, of saying, okay, I feel like we need a brand that makes it easy to be a mindful drinker. And it's been the core thing from the beginning.
So what was the first product that you worked on?
The first products was actually the ones that you can see right here. That was our Ginish and our Rumish bottles. These were the two first ones that rolled off the belt. So our alcohol-free gin and alcohol-free rum. I wanted to start with the base of spirits because I felt that was the most difficult to create a spirit that was satisfying. And the first thing I did was reach out to people that I knew that understood the product development part. So flavorists basically didn't understand when you put flavors together, what happens. They basically opened up their resources to me because they knew that this was a trend that was escalating and that was something that they wanted to be involved in. So we basically got to work and it was everything from taking juniper from Southern Europe, sun-dried juniper. How do we get that into the bottle? How do we take coriander seeds? We found that Provence, France has the best coriander seeds. How do we take those and put into the bottle? With our rum, it was like, how do we get, those notes of like vanilla and, all those kind of
elements. Is this spirit that starts the spirit and then you de-alcoholize it and then you add things back into it to make up for what's missing? Is that the idea?
Well, it's both and actually, okay. Because now cut to today, we're at our third generation of our gin and our rum. So meaning that the first generation was not that. But then we realized, for example, for our rum, if we take real Caribbean rum that we source from Jamaica and Martinique, and we de-alcoholize that and use that as a base in our non-alcoholic rum, well, then we get a better non-alcoholic rum. So that was something that we did in the third generation of our rum to elevate it. And there'll be a fourth generation, a fifth and a sixth generation, because we can always elevate and always make it better. So today we use different techniques. We use de-alcoholization of rum. We use vanilla. We use nutmeg. We use baked apple to create these
baked
notes
apple.
And flavors.
Really? Yeah. Actual baked apple or flavors of
actual
baked apple?
Actual baked apple, mainly for
Who
color,
does the
actually.
Baking? If you've got a kitchen out the back where your mom is baking apples, where do they come from?
The thing is, we build our company to scale. So everybody, all the ingredients that we work with, all of that is scalable. So meaning that we're not cooking the apples in our own kitchen, but we're using ingredients that we have access to in order to always scale, and also to make products locally in order to not bake apples in Denmark and then send them around the world.
But when you say local, where is it based? Where's the production based?
An hour from our office in Copenhagen.
Right. Okay. So going back to the testing, I mean, it's very hard if you come from outside the beverage industry. It, you know, having been a wine judge, it can be really tedious just trying hundreds of different things at a time. How did you find this whole new world of beverages? Did you have other people doing that, or did you sort of go, yeah, I like this one, I don't like this one, I like this one?
So first, it was a one-man band to begin with, so I did everything. So everything from the design to the production to the selling in to the development and to everything. So in the development phase, it was me. And then I knew people that were either bartenders or just really honest, right? You know, all those people that either will say like, great job, just keep, you know, or then there's the ones that are being like, this is crap. You need to do something.
Did you get much of that?
Yes, I did. It took a full year to get the recipes right initially. So it wasn't a walk in the park. And I actually told the developers that we're working with, and I said, you know what? There's three things that needs to be right. And if any of these three legs don't work, we'll just not do the project. Because at that point, like, I didn't go alcohol free for those 100 days to start a brand. That was just a personal journey. Then I realized, hey, let's make a product. But the only reason that I wanted to make a product was because I wanted to make it easy to be a mindful drinker. One of the main reasons, main ways to make it easy to be a mindful drinker is to create mindful or mind-blowing products, yeah, right? That actually taste like you want them to, because it's not hard making an alcohol-free product. There's millions of that, but it's very hard making an alcohol-free product that will give the same experience as an alcoholic version. So I told them we need to use natural ingredients. It has to taste right. Not necessarily good, but right. And that's a really important distinguish, because not everybody likes gin. So good is like, you know, a soft drink that's full of sugar or something. Like, most people will be like, all right, this is sugar, I like it. The brain will tell me it's good. But spirits is different. Like, they have resistance. When you drink clear, you know, like, let's say an alcoholic gin or rum, there's resistance. And not everybody likes that. No, not everybody likes rum. Not everybody likes gin. So it's not about tasting good. It is about tasting right.
Yeah, yeah, interesting.
And right is about that it has to taste like the alcoholic version. So that was always the goal, and still is the goal, to kind of close that gap of the alcoholic experience and the non-alcoholic experience, and just continue to close that gap. And in my opinion, we are closing that gap more than anybody with the development that we've put behind our products. But still, you're still at a point where you can't take our rum and drink it neat and then think that it's a 40 proof rum. We're not there yet. And I haven't met any product out there that's there. But we're getting there, and we're closing and closing and closing that gap. So that was always the three main, and the last one was, it has to be satisfying, yeah, right? So when you drink this, you know that release of dopamine and serotonin that you get from drinking alcohol, where it's like, oh, this was rewarding because I like this flavor. It has to have that. So different components would then reflect that, and we got there, and we continue to make it better and better.
Who's the we you're talking about? So are you doing this by yourself, or who else?
Yeah,
is...
so I always use we, I guess, because there were so many people involved. So technically,
okay,
I was
sole
owner at that point. Yeah, there was just so many people in there, you know, helping and developing and just helping me along. So it was always a we project, even though I was a one man band technically. But now we are we're 16 people at the office today. We export to 25 countries, and we have distribution partners in all countries, local.
Okay, so this is the bit that everybody's interested in. How did you make your first sale? How did you make your first sale? And what was your first sale?
Oh, that's so interesting, because it's so in Denmark, there's so much help, and especially in the food and beverage industry in Denmark. There's so many different organizations, like called Food from Denmark and EU-backed grants and so on. So there's so much help to get. So I remember being at one of these, like, learn how to start a beverage brand kind of thing, you know? And I signed up for everything. And I remember there was a buyer from one of the best supermarket chains, like the most specialty super chains, like a small Whole Foods, I would guess you can kind of call it, you know, like a little Air One, I guess, you know, in Denmark standards. And she was like, anybody here wants to present what they're doing? And nobody said anything. And I was like, take me. And she's like, great. And then I talked about my brand, and we kind of used that as a little bit of a case. And she's like, hey, do you want to come in for a chat? And I came in for a chat, and she's like, we'd like to roll out your product in our stores. And I was like, fantastic. And then obviously I had to get to work and produce some product and so on. So that was the first, retail chain. And then I had, some of the first was also some nice hotels in Copenhagen and so on.
How did that happen? Did you have a little sample bag and you went around and poured it for people? Or did people say, I've tried it in the supermarket, this is amazing? Like, what were the next steps to get those next sales?
It was basically me and my Mini Cooper driving around, giving it to anybody that I could, that was willing to listen. My good friend Brian, he's a handyman, and I told him, can you build a bar that fits in a Mini Cooper? Because I need it, because I was popping that up everywhere, and basically I was getting great feedback. I was getting great feedback on, I think it was 50-50 in terms of. Great feedback on like, we need this. Where have you been? This is great. And then the other 50%, like, what the hell are you doing? Like, don't fuck with my alcohol. Why can't we drink alcohol? And like, you can drink all the alcohol you want, but I'm just putting an element in here that can for your guests maybe that don't want to drink. Like some people got it and some people didn't at all. And I really felt that pioneer element. And what was really interesting is that. Early on, we rolled out in the UK. So in Denmark, it was so early stage and very early days, like immature market, I guess you can call it. And then I remember going to the UK and I did, a product showcase kind of thing. And Seedlip had been around in UK for some years at that point and really done a good job of paving the path for brands like Ish. And I remember being there, everybody's like, oh yeah, alcohol-free, blah, blah, blah. That makes sense. We've to know this and let's try yours. So it was way more normalized. And I just felt that whole like mature market shift coming from Denmark in 2018 to UK or in London was like very, very different.
So I was going to ask you about this later, but I'll ask you about it now. One of the things that's really interesting to me about Denmark is that it's a hotbed of innovation, especially in beverages. Is it because of all of the government support, do you think, or is it that do you liaise with people in Copenhagen and you're all just seeding each other with ideas?
I think it's a little bit of both, to be honest. And I think the latter of that is a universal thing. I think that when you work in food and beverage, there's a lot of unity. That's my experience, at least, because you meet over taste. So somebody has something to taste, and I think that really creates some kind of union. But on the factual part of it, we're a small country, so our export is pretty much our brains and know-how. So the government really supports that. So there's a lot of grants and programs to join as an entrepreneur to really get some solid information and education. So, for example, we get grants for developing our products because it's innovative.
All right.
So we can sign up for these programs and we actually get funding from the government to go out and hire. Like we do all product development in-house, and that has basically been funded, the initial part of it, by these grants.
Oh,
so we have
a
department that only manages product development and works with all kinds of ingredient houses and
when
so
you
on.
Went to the government and you said, my goal is to make a gin that has no gin in it, how did they react?
So they the first one I got declined. So I was trying to do everything myself and I was filling out this and they're just like, this doesn't make any sense. Not necessarily because of the product, but just maybe just because of my lack of filling out the application right. And then I started using consultants. And I think that kind of goes in everything that I've done since in Ish is to really use experts.
So right? You're really good at filling out forms now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and then we have experts that are great at filling out the forms to make sure that we do it right and in other aspects. But they were really excited about it. And the thing is, once we got the grant the second time around, we involved the University of Copenhagen. We involved students that was part of university in 8 different countries that were involved and had different, really, Different, diverse mentalities.
Tell me about the students. Were you testing product on them, or were you getting them involved in making the product? What were you doing with students?
Both. So so we had them taste the products. We had them do analysis. And then we had basically the job was make this taste more like alcohol.
So what sort of students were you working with?
It's called food science and innovation.
Right. Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. So, of course, they get a great project before they graduate. That's interesting.
Exactly.
So
what
was your first export market and how did you get it?
The first one was UK early on. And that was actually also through a Danish program where they were pulling in distributors from different countries. And there was a distributor from the UK that I met and we decided to work together and we ended up rolling out in 900 stores in the UK.
Okay, so I think the lesson of this podcast is go and get Danish citizenship. That's obviously the path to beverage beverage fame and fortune. But of course, you didn't just get the UK market. I'm just looking at my notes. You also got 11 Madison Avenue and Alchemy, which is a very famous Michelin star restaurant in Copenhagen. And you've also got Kjær and Sommerfeld, which I probably have to explain to people is a very, very historic wine store in Copenhagen. It's one of the world's oldest, I think. How did you get into those venues?
So the 11 Madison Park was a fun story because that was just around when Daniel Hum was changing his menu to go vegan.
Yeah,
it's a vegetarian, exactly. And basically, we got an email from the bar guy at 11 Madison Park, and he's like, "Do you guys want to do a tasting?" And it was like, "Yes, that's great." So we'd send over some product. We didn't have any distribution in the U.S. at all. So we sent over product, UPS. We did an online tasting. We had a great session doing that. And then about a week later, he was like, "We want to put these on the menu." And we were just, holy, that is amazing. And we didn't have distribution. So we had to figure out, and I think they bought like 32 cases or something like that, you know, to initially. And they're like, "We need it in a week because we're doing a test dinner. Can you do that?" And we're like, "Yes." And then we're like, "How the hell are we going to do that?" Because we actually were just doing a production and we're kind of running out and we had to do a new production. And it was crazy. It was like cab to the airport and flew it over. And it was like one of those stories where we're like, we made it happen, but it was, holy shit. It was a really, really thrilling process.
And did they come back and go send us some more?
Yeah. So what they do is they switch
up. The airport.
They switch the menu every 3 months. So they kind of rotate in and out. So our spirits are either on the menu or not on the menu, and then they kind of do that. And the wines are there always, like they're main on the menus, but the spirits are kind of in and out every 3 months.
Actually, I hadn't thought about distribution, but because distribution is very interesting because it's a non-alcoholic product, so I guess it's not subject to the same Byzantine regulations that alcohol is in the United States. But who do you go through an alcohol distributor or do you deal directly? How do you distribute it?
We can do both, actually. So in the US, we can work with like Kehi and distributors like that. But we also work with Southern and people that are hardcore, you know, liquor distributors, because essentially our products stand side by side with alcohol. So we need to go through the same channels, not legally, but just from a marketing perspective. So we kind of do both, and we also do direct to consumer, of course.
So when you deal with people who work in the alcohol trade, do you think it's easy or difficult to explain what it is that you're doing? Do they get it instantly, or is there an education process?
I would say we've had a little bit of both, and I think that goes back to also to some of the ones that we're working with, where if we talk to like the real classic alcohol distributors 3 years ago, they might be like this and be like, "Nah, not really." But now they're really opening up. Places like Kjær Sommerfeld that are like, we know that this is going to be a category you need to serve our customers. We think this is exciting. Let's do it proper. But they might not have thought that way, or they didn't think that way 3 years ago. right? So the same thing we're seeing in the US, some are ready and some are not. And we decided very early on, we are pioneers and we learn that every single day. So we want to work with the people that want to work with us. We want to work with the ones that want to do something with the non-alcoholic industry, because we don't want to force anything into anybody. Because if we do that, it's not going to work. So if we go into a bar or with a distributor or whatever, and they say, sure, we'll take it, we'll put it down here, and if somebody asks, we'll serve it, and be like, you're not going to get it then. Give it back. Don't put it in there, because it's not going to work. So we want to put it on the menu. If you want to put it front and center, you want to make sure you do an effort and so on, because nobody's going to come in and ask, like, what's your selection of non-alcoholic tequilas, right? I mean, we're not there. So we really need to make an effort. So the ones that we work with are the ones that want to do something about this category, and then it's working.
So there's a lot of discussion in alcohol policy at the moment. Don't ask me how I know about this, about where these products should sit. Some people are saying they should be age-gated, and young people shouldn't be allowed to have these non-alcoholic products because they look like alcohol and it'll be training wheels for alcohol. And other people are like, no, what's your opinion about this?
Well, it's 100% not a segue into alcohol. It's just not. It's the opposite around. It's a segue out of alcohol. And I think that we're seeing a lot of resistance from big alcohol. And that's something as a pioneer as well we need to navigate. Fortunately, I am also on the board of ANBA, the Adult Non-Alcoholic Beverage Association, which is the world's first association for non-alcoholic products, to really make sure that we speak up about legislation and compliance and so forth, because there are some very weird things happening.
Tell me about the weird things happening. What weird things are? I'm actually surprised to hear you say that the big alcohol companies are resistant, because I know that the really big ones are putting huge amounts of money and resources into trying to develop this sector. So tell me about the weird things. What's the weirdest thing that's going on?
So the weird things is like in the UK when there's a conversation about should 0.5% be low alcoholic or should it be alcohol, or and should it be 0.0% be alcohol free and so forth. And the problem with that is that when you have 0.5% is alcohol free and everything below is alcohol free, as it should be, because you can have a goma dressing or a soy that you put on your sushi and it has 0.something in there. So there's a ripe banana, etc. So there's a bunch of everyday products, even sodas, that will have 0.something. And because they don't market it as a non-alcoholic beverage, they don't have to declare that. We, as a non-alcoholic beverage, have to declare that, which is fair. And I think, the more we declare, the better. The problem is then if 0.something in a non-alcoholic beverage should be classified as low alcoholic, because then you're going to limit that access to the consumer. And by doing that, then you're basically creating roadblocks for more non-alcoholic sales. And the thing is, we know from the WHO, the World Health Organization, that the detriment of alcohol, and about 13 of the 17 global goals are undermined by alcohol. We see Denmark.
You're talking about the sustainability development goals. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. The global goals. Exactly. So anything from, that's a whole conversation on its own. So what European countries has gone in and said is we want to do an effort of lowering alcohol consumption because we know that's going to create a healthier society. So then when you create roadblocks of saying, well, then it has to be 0.0. Well, even the 0.0 products are not 0.0. They're 0.0 something. If you want to create a halal product, which is alcohol-free, of course, it can be up to 0.05. So there has to be borders, and you want to make sure that you create a flow and remove roadblocks for non-alcoholic brands and products. Because if you don't, then people are going to drink more alcohol. So that's the whole counterintuitive part and the weird thing about a lot of those suggestions and things that are going on at the moment.
All right. Yeah, it's interesting. So I'll get back to your product. How big is your production now? How much are you producing?
I'm unsure in terms of liters and hectoliters and so on, but we are, I think over the years, you could say we're doubling year on year.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you're in 25 markets now. You've also got offerings across wine and spirit. Can you talk about how different these are in terms of production?
They are very different. So we have we're 16 people, and three of them are in supply chain, and two of them are in product development. So just to give an idea of like a third of our team is about product. It's about developing product, and it's about navigating the product and the supply chain. So our spirits, we do locally in Copenhagen, or like an hour outside Copenhagen, which is their own production facility, etc. The wines we do together with winemakers, either in Germany or France or Spain. So that's, we work locally there. So the grapes grow locally, the de-alkalization happens locally, and so forth. So that's its own ecosystem. And the canned cocktails that we have, the pre-mixed cocktails, are being canned in Austria, developed by us, and then canned in Austria. So it's
why Austria? Has Austria got special expertise in canned cocktails?
They do. They have the big machinery, so they can run the volume that we need. So yeah, they're just the best at doing it, basically.
Huh, the things you learn. Yeah. I didn't know that. So going back to the wine, I mean, one of the things that's made the wine category very, very difficult is that the de-alcoholization does not improve the taste of it. There's some real taste barriers with wine. Are you doing any research around that, or how are you working with wine?
So we are working both with sparkling wine and still wine. And the sparkling wines are easier. To be honest, because what happens with alcohol is that you create volatility. So the alcohol evaporates and the flavors will become volatile and therefore kind of create volume, right? So that's when you take a sip of something with alcohol, it really like hits all your senses. With the carbonation in the sparkling wine, that helps with the aromas. So the de-alkalization is incredibly important. We do that, you know, very carefully. We do it with low temperatures. We do it with great grapes. And then we take care of that. The carbonation makes sure that we get the right amount of experience once it hits the palate. The still wines are incredibly difficult because you don't have any help. So we're still working on that. We have launched different wines to kind of put out there, small batches to kind of test and see, working with great grapes, but it is very difficult. And I would say on that those specific products, we have the biggest gap, like I mentioned before, about closing that gap up to the alcohol experience. On the still wines, especially the red, is the biggest gap right now. So we're researching different ways of actually doing production. So not just the de-alkalization part and the carbonation or the, you know, added ingredients or whatever. We want to go back to the, how do you produce this? What kind of yeast do you use? It's what happened in beer. Once you had the right yeast, which was, funny enough, a wine yeast, you could actually produce the beer. You can brew the beer, but it didn't give all the alcohol. So you could do like a fully brewed beer, and you actually got some really good performing products taste-wise. And I think that's something that needs to happen with the wine in order for that to get to that level of satisfaction.
Yeah, it's an interesting problem. I know in Portugal they're trying to use bacteria to ferment the wine instead, but nobody's cracked that problem yet. There's just too much alcohol as opposed to beer. Let me see. So are you going to keep all of your production facilities in Denmark, or do you foresee a day when you'll have production facilities in the US and maybe in Asia?
We can do it. We have built our company to scale, and we've built it to do locally. So right now we're doing it here in these local markets, but there's no reason why we wouldn't be able to do it in the US or in Asia or whatever. So that's built around that. So once the volume is high enough, then we do it locally.
And I also see that your products are covered in medals from competitions. What's the benefit of entering into competitions?
So we work with skepticism. That is our line of business. When people hear, do you want to try a non-alcoholic gin tonic? Do you want to try a non-alcoholic Paloma? Then the first thing they will think, if they haven't tried it before, is skepticism. And the way to create credibility around it is, you know, one thing is working with Levin Medicine Park and Alchemist and so on. And the other thing is medals. And it's basically a proof or a trust factor to say, this product received 3 stars at the Great Taste Award, and therefore you can trust it. So it's that's basically what it is. There's a lot of awards out there. Some of them are BS, and some are not. And we try to navigate those that are actually a fully judging panel, sitting behind it, giving their honest opinion, and so on. So today we have one of the world's broadest and most award-winning ranges, which we're incredibly proud of. And it just speaks into that narrative of that the product is the most important thing in everything that we do.
Yeah, one of the things I was really interested that you said in a presentation you gave is you said in 2021 and 2022, people were searching Pinterest for fancy drinks. Is that still happening?
Absolutely. Yeah. It is. It's inspiration they're looking for, essentially. So that can be Pinterest, but it can also be, you know, Instagram and everything else. But they're really looking for inspiration. And they're also especially looking for inspiration in real life in terms of bars and restaurants. So when they go out, when they navigate the menu, etc., and getting that experience, they really get to that, like, oh, this makes sense. We had a great example of that. We work with Ford cars. So we did a drink and drive event at a fancy cocktail bar in the middle of Copenhagen. There were 3 cars parked outside, and people came in, invited. They had cocktails. They could drive the cars, etc. And it was so interesting to see how people reacted in that, because one thing is the cars and the cocktails, but it's also the fact that when they tried this cocktail in a restaurant or a cocktail bar served by like professional bartenders, they were mind blown. And they were getting like, this was Friday afternoon. They're like, I'm feeling like I'm getting this, you know.
Yeah, actually, so I'm fascinated that you've actually had promotions with cars, because one of the most interesting things about the non-alc, well, I mean, there's many interesting things about the non-alc space, but one of it is this placebo effect where you can actually feel like you're getting drunk even though there's no alcohol at all. How did you convince car companies to work with an alcohol-adjacent product? I mean, it's a very interesting choice.
It took a while because I needed someone that was brave enough to actually
do it. It is a brave thing to do. I mean, I can imagine you get criticized a lot. So. Yeah. How did it work? How did you convince them?
So I pitched them the idea, and I pitched them the idea of like, so car brands going electric, they're going mindful as well. Yeah. They want to make sure that they communicate that. And instead of doing it as every other car company is doing by, the communication that we've heard a million times, I was like, what if we do it a little different? What if we attach it to something else that's mindful and not just talk about trees and so on, which is of course important, but how do you talk about that still, but then do a platform where you can actually communicate in a way that you get people kind of out of their shell and kind of give them an experience? Because that whole experiential marketing, I think, is so important. So when they had their cars come in, they had their dealers come in, they had their customers come in, and they tried it in this environment, they remembered. Right. So that was kind of the kicker of like, you want to do something that people remember. And nobody's really done this. I haven't seen anybody do this in this degree enough. And it's so obvious to do drink and drive, obviously. But nobody has really had that brief.
It must feel quite subversive doing it. I mean, just the thought of holding something that looks like alcohol and is a really good analog for alcohol and then driving. I mean, it must feel quite barrier breaking, actually. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what we need. I think we need that, in the communication to give people an experience that is out of the ordinary.
I mean, out of the ordinary. So, what other marketing activations have you done?
So we've done festivals. Last summer we did 2 big festivals in Copenhagen. This summer we're doing another 2 big festivals. So what was really interesting here was we were like, you know, again, we're pioneers, and I keep using that word because we're always the new kid on the block, right? No matter where we go. And in festivals in Denmark, it has never really been done before, like doing like a full-on proper, we had like a 6-meter-tall, 5-meter-long bar where we did all mindful drinking. So here we actually did a no-low concept, so no and low alcoholic cocktails. And we were open for 4 days, 12 hours a day, and we sold a drink or 0.7 drink every minute. It was a huge success. And what we realized that, and this was even like at a rock fest or like a heavy metal festival, you know, where we're like, this is going to be really interesting how people are going to react to this. So it's a big experiment. And they loved it. Even the bands that were there, like Tool was one of the bands playing. They got a case of our pink Paloma and our mojito, right? Because they just don't want to drink a bunch of alcohol. You know, they play heavy metal and they're, you know, full on. But, you know, they don't want to drink a bunch of alcohol. So it was a big success. And at festivals, it's one of those things where you're like, you're there for a full day. There's always a lot of alcohol. But if you can get a little break from that, if you can be a little bit mindful, you know, the statistic that we all know, about 80% of non-alcohol consumers also consume alcohol. So they want something adjacent to the alcohol. They want the Paloma taste or the spritz or the sparkling wine or the gin tonic or the dark and stormy or whatever. And they want to get that experience, but they also want to just take a little break in between during the day. So that was a big success.
What I'm learning is that Ish is very good at putting bars together. You started with the Cooper and now you've got big festival bars. And do you have a warehouse where you've got all these bars stored now?
Yeah, we do actually. We do. We have a big big space with all our merch and we're actually doing, we have a bar every Friday at a place called Plugin, which is a heat club. So it's a sauna goose ice bath concept here in Copenhagen. And every Friday they do heat clubbing. So instead of going out, you go to the sauna club and you just rave like crazy. There's DJs, there's, you know, tons of activities.
Okay, you're going to have to explain how that works. So what do you do? You go and put yourself in the ice bath and then you go to the sauna? And where does the DJ come in?
Yeah, so this is a concept in Denmark that some friends of mine started. It's a sauna. So you do sauna goose. You go into the sauna, it's like 100 degrees, and they do, you know, where you swirl the towel, you get, like, it's very hot. You go out, you get in the ice bath for like a minute or two, you cool down, you go back in the sauna, and you kind of go back and forth three times. In those times that you're out, there's an Ish bar right there, so you're serving alcohol-free cocktails. There's a DJ raving, and it's a whole concept of actually clubbing, where you get these because you're releasing so much serotonin and dopamine when you're in the sauna and the ice bath. You combine that with drinking alcohol-free and the music, and you felt like you're there for a couple of hours, and you felt like you've been out at the club. And then you do whatever you want from there. People go home, they chill, and they have a nice day the day after. But it's, again, a way of socializing and being together where it's not necessarily about drinking alcohol, but about creating an environment that's just full-on experiential.
Okay, so I have to ask you this. So I'm recording this from Germany, and saunas here are all of your clothes off. Is that what you do in Denmark as well, or do people go to these raves and still have clothes and towels on?
These specific ones, they have clothes on.
Right.
But I know there are some. I know Germany is different on the nudity, and maybe they'll do one in Denmark once that's full nudity. But that will probably be announced beforehand, or people will get a shock.
Yep. Okay. So you said you're in 25 countries. What have you learned about different markets? I mean, how is the US different from, say, the UK? In terms of doing business there, I mean, we know they've got a different system of distribution and so on, but in terms of doing business, how is the US different?
Honestly, I think it's very similar. Really? Because, there's always the different ways of building up DSD and import distribution and FDA and all kinds of things, but we've kind of put that aside. It's very similar. It's a market where there are consumers that are looking for easy ways to drink mindfully. So it's the same need from the consumer that we're seeing in Germany, that we're seeing in US, that we're seeing in Denmark or Sweden or Netherlands or Spain or whatever. It's this explorative way of saying, hey, I'm having I'm looking at my relationship with alcohol and I want to kind of explore alternatives. And then they seek the market, and Ish is one of those brands that are out there. Then it's about us figuring out how do we make sure we get our product out there and known, right? So we have to find the right distributor to work with, that we align with. We need to make sure that distributor has the muscle to put it into the market. We support them from the headquarters. And then there's that whole way of doing it. Some markets we go straight into retail. Other markets we go more heavy on the on-premise and the on-trade. So it's different, but we're kind of fluid in that way. So we're not like, Ish always has to start here. Like, We don't have that. We explore. We figure out what's working in the different markets. If we see a little fire, we'll add more sticks to it and build a bigger fire. And that's kind of how we navigate. So there's not like a straight arrow line in how we do it every single time. But we have enough experience to understand what works if we need to go into the on-trade. What needs to be done for us to do this? What needs to be done in retail if we go into retail to make sure we rotate? Because one thing is, of course, getting distribution and being in a market, but the rotation that you're judged on, that is always the main thing. And that is different from market to market. And we're seeing different maturity levels, right? So in Denmark, we've been for a long time, we're seeing an amazing rotation. New markets that we go into that might not have had any other products, very low rotation that needs to be built up slowly in order to get to that velocity levels. And we have to make sure that we work with the buyers that they understand that, that it takes time to build up and educate the consumers.
And who is the consumer? And is the consumer the same across all of these markets? Or do you find very different people in different markets?
We've defined it in a way where an ish consumer starts where you start having responsibilities for other than yourself.
All right, that's interesting. Hmm.
And the reason why we say that is that we are not targeting super young that are might not be drinking, might be drinking, whatever. We're kind of in that phase of people's life where you start a family or you want to start a family. You have a career. You want to do more with your career. You have responsibility for other than yourself. And that means that you have less time for yourself because you're dividing your time with your community, whatever that looks like. And in those phases, people are realizing that maybe the alcohol is kind of slowing me down, kind of like I experience. They're realizing that it's actually taking time away. I don't want to waste half a Sunday and so forth. So we're basically giving people time. And that's why we use the payoff feel free, because that's exactly what it is, to be free. And feel free to drink, feel free to go out, feel free to do whatever, but have an option that makes it easy for you to adhere to your healthy lifestyle for that desire that you have. So this can be male, it can be female, it can be many age groups, but mainly from like 25 to 45-ish, and a little bit steered towards female. But again, it's very diverse.
And when Ish entered the market, there were products around, there was C-Lip and so on, but this market has really grown since you've entered. So how do you maintain your position? Or is it that the market is just growing so fast there's room for everybody at the moment? But how are you going to keep your competitive advantage now? There's so many new entrants.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great question. And there's two sides of that coin, because one side is it's great that we're seeing more brands, especially the big brands, because that's growing the category. It's manifesting the category. So that's great. Products that come out needs to be good in order for consumers to have a good experience with it. So we want to make sure that the category puts out good products, right? That will give people a good experience and not the other way around. And we want to make sure that the I guess the input and the output follows along, right? So you can have a lot of brands rushing into a category, but the output will kind of have its own life, right? So we can see a lot of brands, but also a lot of brands that have very low rotation and low revenue. So then some people will probably go away, and then it'll be kind of a cleaned up a little bit in that. So I think it's. I'm trying to find the right words here, but it's great that we're seeing such an influx, but we're also seeing that the consumer will take the product according to what they need, right? So I think right now there might be too much going into the market than getting pulled from the market in terms of from the consumer, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I've tried a lot of non-alcoholic products, and a lot of them suffer from one of two things. Either they have way too much sugar. There's a lot that have got very high levels of sugar. Or the other thing is that too many people go to flavor scientists and construct something, and it's got a very chemical kind of aftertaste to it. So
no, but I think what I'm hearing is that it's quality, right?
Yeah.
We need quality. And I think that once a mature category will have premium, medium, low range, high sugar, low sugar. Like it'll have different niches under its category. Let's say soda, for example, right? You have soft drinks, right? You have really premium soda. You have like mainstream sodas. You have like discount sodas. You have sugar-free. You have a bunch within that, and a lot of people drink soda, and you know, so there's room for everybody. If you have an alcohol-free category that people are still understanding, and you have as much fragmentation within that, then there's not a big enough pie for everybody to be successful.
Yeah, yeah.
If that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So, and not necessarily that we need less brands, because I love all the brands that are coming in, and I love speaking with them and helping if I can in any way. But I think we need to understand that, and I think that from an industry perspective, we're reading a lot of articles of like massive growth and so much growth, and everybody wants this. But at the end of the day, when you put it into a new market in a retail chain, you have to build that rotation slowly. So that means if you put 15 products into a shelf, 15 products might be rotating slowly. Maybe you put 5 in there and they rotate higher, and then you build it slowly. So then maybe after 2 years, you have 15 products. So I think that's where I'm trying to go with this, is that we need to be patient in the category and not just rush in and just throw it all out there, but need to kind of make sure that the pull from the market, from the consumer, kind of balances a little bit, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And do you think that the market will ultimately go towards non-alcoholic always remaining this kind of analog? So the analog of gin and tonic, the analog of bourbon, or do you think it will develop so that you get different styles of drink entirely?
Both. I think both. And I think that we'll have even more. We have already functional beverages that are nootropics and so on. And we'll probably have some more fragmentations as well. So I think there'll be both. I think there are the consumers that crave that gin tonic feeling, but don't want the alcohol. And I think that's why we're seeing alcohol-free beer is the 70% of the category, because people like the taste of beer, but they don't always want the alcohol, so they get that, right? And I think the same goes with wine, spirits, and cocktails. But I also think that there's room for gastro juice and interesting proxies and so on that will do something different, that might have functional advantages and so on. So I think we'll get there. I just want to make sure that, or my message is just that, let's be patient and let's make sure we build the input according to the output.
Okay, so finally, what's next for Ish? I know you're working on a zero degree bourbon. How's that going? But do you see yourself staying within this space, or do you think one day you'll be in functional drinks and protein drinks and whatever else?
So I think for us, we want to make it easy to be a mindful drinker. So if we see that there's lacking a non-alcoholic bourbon that could make it easier for people to be mindful drinkers, then it's our job to create that. We don't want to create an alcohol-free bourbon if it's not the best one out there, because like I said initially, the world doesn't need any more products, and the world doesn't necessarily need more Ish products. It only needs products that actually make a difference. So when we put out a product, we want to make sure that it's the top of its game and actually goes out and makes a difference. So we haven't launched a zero bourbon because we can't get it right. It's not there. And we've worked on it for a couple of years now at least. And we don't feel it's good enough to put out. So we don't. But we'll be working on the wines more. So the wines are still an experiment. And we feel like we are doing something really interesting and different we have a red wine that we've oak infused and really created something that is the best red that I've ever tried. Very small production, but it can still be better. So that's a focus area for us, the wines.
My final question, having given up meat for a while and having given up alcohol for a while, did you ever go back to them? Do you eat meat now or do you drink alcohol ever?
Yeah, both.
All right. Okay, good.
But I do it mindfully. And I think that's just the kind of person I am, is that I just want to make sure that whatever I do or whatever I eat or drink is something that I've made a decision around, mm-hmm. right? So often when I go out and I drink, it's I would say 7 out of 10 times it's alcohol-free. 2 out of 10 times it's both and. Like it's probably 50-50. And then 1 out of 10 times it's full on alcohol and there's no tomorrow. So I think that's kind of it when it comes to food. You know, my wife and I, we eat a lot of vegetarian food. We get like food subscriptions. So we always have, you know, at least 3 or 4 meals a week that is fully vegetarian or fully vegetarian. But I also will eat, you know, a steak once in a while. So that's, and I think that also goes for kind of the feeling of ish and why we call it mindful drinking. It's that it's about creating products that makes that easy for people, and we don't judge either one way or the other. Feel free, do whatever you feel like. We're just here to add in a choice for everybody, and we feel that's the most inclusive and right thing to do.
On that note, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome.